Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. I hope you are all doing well on this Friday. It is the 6th of April. We're in the first Friday of a new month. But the most important part of that phrase is that it's Friday.
Yay.
So good morning. And I hope you are going to enjoy it and hope you have good weekend plans. Let me introduce our panel to you. We have quite a panel today. We have a lot to talk about. We have a lot to talk about. So we'll get to all that in just a moment. First, Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning, sir.
Yo, yo, Joe.
How are you? Everything going well?
Yo, 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 yeah.
Excellent. Aaron Pasitti is with us. He is a professor of economics at Siena College in Loudonville, New York. He is with us this morning, and we're always thrilled when he joins us on the panel.
Good morning.
Good morning. We need your expertise this morning because we're going to talk tariff and trade, and we need your help.
So does the rest of the country.
That's right. Judith Enck is with us. She is the former regional administrator for the United States Environmental Protection Agency. And I don't know if you realize this, but the EPA has been in the news a lot lately. So we're going to tap into Judith's knowledge of the agency and do a contrast and compare with her a little bit as to the good old days when she was a part of the Obama administration and what's going on currently. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm okay.
All right. Well, we'll take care of that. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. All right. Well, let's start with the EPA. This seems to be the gift that just keeps on giving. There's a pair of articles that I was looking at last night, and one is just the basic Scott Pruitt is in trouble article, and the job is in jeopardy amid expanding ethics issues. So here's basically what happened yesterday. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt fought for his job, facing a new barrage of allegations about issues ranging from his past housing arrangement and first-class travel to the reassignment of senior staff who criticized how he was spending taxpayer funds. The New York Times did an amazing article on the Pruitt tenure as EPA chairman, or administrator, rather, and it talks everything about him wanting a fancy desk to making sure that when he goes to his steakhouse that he has flashing lights and sirens in his motorcade. Usually that's just the president, but...
And occasionally the vice president.
And now the EPA administrator. So the people who have worked with him say that this is an ongoing issue. Also, we have another New York Times report of saying that at least five officials at the EPA, four of them high-ranking, were reassigned or demoted or requested new jobs in the past year after they raised concerns about the spending and management of the agency's administrators. So I just want to make that point because while we're talking about the questions of spending and management, the new part of this story is that people have actively come out, have gone to the administration, have voiced their concern. These are people within the Trump administration and long-term lifers at the EPA who have all expressed concern, and there is some retribution for that. So,
now, Joe, with the risk of saying something out of, you know, pique, it is interesting that Elise Stefanik this last night at a town meeting announced that Pruitt should resign.
Yeah, she's the third House Republican to do that. And I tweeted a thank you to Elise Stefanik because I've been quite critical of her really low environmental voting record. But here she decided to step out and announce to cheers from her constituents that Pruitt should step aside.
And this is a Trumpian. In other words, you don't get more Trumpian than Elise Stefanik has been. So somebody is getting a little worried here, right?
Well, it seems that way, although the president yesterday, as he was coming back from a campaign stop in West Virginia, which we'll get to later, but his comment there was, well, the people of West Virginia love Scott Pruitt.
And that's why Pruitt may survive this? Because unlike other cabinet officials who were booted out, Pruitt has a deep constituency with big oil, with big agriculture, with the chemical industry, mm-hmm. and right-wing conservative media celebrities who are really rallying to urge the president to keep him. But when you look at the facts, I don't see long-term how he survives. I mean, my personal view is it's not a question of whether he gets fired or resigns. It's a question of when he is criminally indicted, because he has violated federal ethics laws, which are quite strict. I mean, a quick story. When I started in the Obama administration, my first few weeks, all the political appointees were brought down to the White House for a day-long ethics training, where we were told by the White House counsel's office there will not be one ethics controversy during President Obama's term, and there wasn't, I might add. And I'll always remember the assistant White House counsel lecturing us and telling us, look, by definition, you all are political appointees, so members of Congress and lobbyists are going to call you. If there's ever a moment where you feel like you're being pressured to do something that is even remotely wrong, here's my home number, here's my desk number, here's my cell phone number, call me immediately. I will guide you through this. And they, I by the way, never got that briefing when I worked in state government, but I was so impressed that ethics was a top priority. And Scott Pruitt also received an ethics briefing, probably not as rigorous as the one I got. But he, you know, I want to point out that this is consistent with some of the way he operated when he was in Oklahoma state government. So it's startling.
So Judith, were you somewhat surprised to see that the president, according to news reports, wanted to promote Pruitt to the attorney generalship of the United States?
No, because Pruitt has really been angling for that. And I think I can't imagine that happening because he's a lawbreaker. How can he be the first, you know, the top law enforcement person? But I also think what's at stake here is Trump's personality. Apparently, Chief of Staff John Kelly is telling him to boot Pruitt. Members of Congress, Alan, as you just mentioned, Elise Stefanik, a very conservative member, is calling for Pruitt to be let go. And I think because this is so high profile, Trump may just dig in his heels and not do the obvious thing. But my view is he will eventually do it. And this is, again, a moment where journalism and dogged reporting is saving the day. There will be more stories. I mean, once you cross this Rubicon of $50 a night in a luxury condo, you're just
provided
so,
by a lobbyist.
Yes, the spouse of a lobbyist. You once you do stuff like that, that's your ethical DNA. There's other stuff, and we've heard a lot of other stuff.
Kind of sounds familiar to another certain politician who has fallen behind on bills to his employees and contractors.
Hmm. That's right. You're talking about the president, of course.
Yes.
But one of the reasons I suggest, because I'm sure we'll get a letter on the possibility that Pruitt would become the attorney general. He can't because he would have to be confirmed by Congress, and that ain't going to happen.
I don't think so. I think if you were already Senate confirmed for another cabinet position, you can slide in and become the attorney general. So Trump is looking at who does he have who's already Senate confirmed? Because, Alan, I think you're right. A new nominee would not make it through the Senate, but you can do a lateral move.
I've learned something.
It's like rearranging the deck ship, the chairs on the deck of the Titanic, to be honest.
Yeah.
And Pruitt is an attorney. You do have to be a lawyer to be the attorney general.
Now, the actual meanwhile, what's happening at the EPA? Because all of these people are leaving. I mean, so let's go back a year. Mm-hmm. You were on this program, mm-hmm. and were telling us all the good thing is that you have these longtime EPA people who have been there. They're lifers. They will right the ship. They will keep everything going. And well, they're being reassigned. They're leaving. So that core is being gutted quite severely.
Yeah, I was absolutely wrong on this. And what's happened is, and I cannot appear before the EPA for 2 years because of the Obama ethics rules, but I can talk to people personally. I just can't advocate for them. And I've got a bunch of friends there. And what they tell me is none of the scientists or lawyers or engineers are let into the room when important decisions are made. Scott Pruitt has a very small group of political appointees. They don't consult with the scientists. They don't consult with the career staff. They just say, hey, you guys who spent the last, guys and gals, you spent the last 6 years working on the Clean Power Plan, well, we're going to repeal it. And we expect you to do all the administrative work within 2 weeks and get it back to us. The good thing is Pruitt is losing a lot of these cases in court when Attorney General Eric Schneiderman and Maura Healey or environmental groups like Earth Justice or Natural Resources Defense Council sue him. He's losing a lot, which is good. But the agency is just completely decimated. People are embarrassed to work there. What they were most upset about is Pruitt essentially denying climate change. So these ethical transgressions are just salt in an already open wound.
So how much of that is by design? Because, you know, if you essentially set up an agency to fail, you can point to that agency and say, well, look, government is ineffective, and then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Like, is this by design?
Well, we still have the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and all these laws that protect our health and our families' health. And Congress has been, I think, way too passive in terms of exercising oversight. I mean, I've been publicly critical of Elise Stefanik for not being more aggressive at looking at the problems at the EPA, because in the Adirondacks, you know, we had a big acid rain problem that was getting better. Because Pruitt is not enforcing the Clean Air Act, acid rain will get worse, climate change will get worse. But Aaron, I think you're right. They want to point to, see, the agency can't get anything done. Remember, President Trump and Pruitt proposed cutting the EPA budget by 31%, and Congress rejected that entirely and kept the current budget as is.
I think it was President Reagan's budget advisor, David Stockman, who coined the term starve the beast. Mm-hmm. And that is, if you deprive the government of the resources necessary to do its job effectively, then you will by definition get small government, and small government or completely ineffectual government is exactly what Trump and his administration want.
Right.
And you have the double whammy here of both the EPA and the Interior Department, right?
Oh, yeah. Interior is just opening up all our public lands for oil and gas drilling, including coastal in our ocean. Interior was in town in Albany a few weeks ago. I went to that public hearing, which was so disturbing. It wasn't really a public hearing. You just walked from table to table and heard from the U.S. Department of Interior why oil and gas drilling in our ocean and Gulf of Mexico is a good thing. It is very Orwellian. And don't forget Department of Energy with that great guy from Dancing with the Stars, Rick Perry. And HHS plays a really crucial role in CDC on health protection. I mean, there's no level of health and environmental protection that exists anymore in the federal government.
All right. So, crystal ball, Alan, does Pruitt survive the weekend?
Yes, he does. I think, you know, Trump thinks he's on a roll right now. He is a guy who is so filled with himself that he is not going to reverse himself. Right now, does Pruitt survive in the long run? I think Judith is right on the money. If he's criminally indicted, then he goes.
Yeah, I agree with that. And if there's time, I want to share one Pruitt story that illustrates how bad he is.
Can you tell that story in 2 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
So you know, there's this whole litany of problems with Pruitt. But
I didn't know how bad it was.
I so want to zero in on his Morocco trip. He went to Morocco with seven EPA staff plus his security detail, traveled first class, and apparently the point of the trip is to convince the government of Morocco to import liquefied natural gas. Just the trip itself, they flew to Paris first, spent a Saturday in Paris. Seven federal employees apparently missed their flight on 10 a.m. on Sunday morning, so needed to spend Sunday in Paris. When they finally got to Morocco, the whole point was to promote American export of liquefied natural gas, something that an EPA administrator would never, ever do. That's not in their wheelhouse. Well, guess what? There's only one liquefied natural gas export terminal at the time, and that was owned by Cheniere Energy. And the condo where Pruitt was staying at below market rate, the spouse of the owner of the condo is the lobbyist for Cheniere Energy. And on top of that, Carl Icahn is the controlling shareholder of Cheniere Energy. And Carl Icahn, along with a guy named Mr. Ham from Oklahoma, who's a big fracking company, both Icahn and Ham were largely responsible for Pruitt getting his job. This is not the way the federal EPA should be functioning, either from an environmental perspective or a taxpayer fiscal responsibility perspective.
I believe it was you, Alan, yesterday, who asked the ever-sobering question that if Pruitt goes, then what?
Well, the number two would be a guy named Tom Wheeler, who's not yet been appointed by through approval through the Senate, and he's a coal industry lobbyist, and he'll be just as bad as Pruitt, but I think he'll have a hard time getting confirmed with the Senate being so narrow. So then you go, there are four political appointees at EPA that would be eligible to step in. They'd all be pretty bad, but not as bad as Pruitt and Wheeler. But I think there's the ability to block Wheeler's confirmation, given his background, and that there are a couple Republican senators, unfortunately due to illness, can't make it to Washington to vote.
It sounds like the EPA is turning into the FFPA, the Fossil Fuel Protection.
Yeah, and don't forget chemicals. Yeah.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok is here. Judith Enck is with us, and Aaron Pasitti. We welcome your letters. Again, it's panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Again, when we come back, we'll talk letters. We'll also find out what's happening when it comes to China and tariffs. That's a huge issue. We'll put you on the spot, Mr. Pasitti, Professor Pasitti, and we'll be back after this short break.
Yesterday is just a memory. Tomorrow's never what it's supposed to be. And oh, how I need you.
Betty Levette this morning. We love her very, very much. And she's going to be at Helsinki Hudson on Saturday. That's April 7th, Saturday. Otherwise known as tomorrow, by the way. HelsinkiHudson.com. HelsinkiHudson.com. Betty Levette. She has a new album out of Bob Dylan covers. It's called Things Have Changed. And Betty Levette will be hearing from her throughout the morning. So very fun. Again, HelsinkiHudson.com for more information. Also, real quick, want to mention the fact that with us talking about the EPA and climate change and the environment, a reminder that the WAMC panel climate event is happening on April 20th, and it is at Page Hall in Albany, just a few blocks away from WAMC's studios. And we have tickets available. We opened up the balcony yesterday, and those tickets are whooshing out quite fast. But we still have some, so if you're interested, now's the time to do it. It's WAMC.org. Judith will be on the panel. people have.
Oh yeah, but I'm the small fish. I mean, Joe has pulled together an amazing all-star panel of Elizabeth Colbert, who writes for The New Yorker, Terry Tempest Williams, who's one of the most amazing writers you'll ever experience, and local guy Jeff Goodall, who works for Rolling Stone and who just published an incredible book, The Water Will Come: Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. And then me. So I think I'll
think you hold your own. Okay.
Yeah. I'm a little nervous about this panel. These are the all-stars.
Well, they're all excited. They're all excited to meet you. And also, you mentioned Jeff, but Jeff has an amazing article out about Jeff Pruitt in
Rolling Stone.
In Rolling Stone. Yeah, yeah. That's worth reading.
Yeah. I'm sure. And Jeff traveled to Antarctica, I think, with President Obama.
Yeah, Alaska.
On climate change. And so I just want to make a pitch for teachers out there, both high school and college teachers. Please bring your students. This is free and open to the public and an amazing community service brought to us by WAMC and Joe and Alan. It's a hot ticket, as they say, and the price is right.
Yeah, it's WAMC.org, WAMC.org, and you can get your tickets there. So
Now, Joe, I don't want to see Judith putting herself down, because I fully expect that when the next Democrat is elected, she'll be the EPA administrator. She should be.
And we'll have Jeff Goodall in charge of climate change and Betsy Colbert in charge of protecting endangered species, and Terry Tempest can be the communications director.
I like it. It's all good. If Judith ran the world.
And in my mind, I think I do. But
don't we all?
All right, we have some letters. Let's get to those and go to Lee, who says, esteemed panel, two take-home points. One, when Trump goes off script, it is neither extemporaneous nor fact-based. These are instead rehearsed deceptions, just like on TV. If Stormy can create such consternation on the president's part, what about what Putin has on him? This man's life, I speculate, may be in peril. Just my opinion. We'll get to the president going off script in West Virginia, but he referred to his prepared remarks as boring, literally threw them out into the audience and went off script for a while. So
probably made his speechwriters and John Kelly feel really good.
Yeah. I think Bono's allowed to do that, but I don't know about Trump.
But by the way, everyone was saying it was so scary when he did that, but his remarks would have been scary, too.
Right.
I mean, even if you stayed with the script, it still would have been frightening. So, all right. But Keith says there are some troubling economic indicators. The S&P price-to-earnings ratio is the highest in the world, and the U.S. Treasury 10-year bond yield curve is flattening. These are two of the most accurate economic indicators of a looming recession. With 9 years of sustained economic growth, a recession bound to happen. Is now a good time to be starting a trade war? I miss no drama Obama. We'll get into the trade war stuff, but do you want to answer the question?
Yeah, so the Treasury bond yield is a pretty good indicator of economic performance, but the stock market's one of 10 or 15 leading indicators that the National Bureau of Economic Research, who officially dates recessions, looks at. So even though that's coming down, that's probably just a mild correction from the completely unwarranted run-up in stock prices during Trump's first year. So recessions always happen. Economists have predicted 10 of the last two recessions. So there's a lot of other signs that point to an economy being stronger than just what the stock market reports.
They have predicted 10 of the last two.
Yeah. The way economists get notoriety is by making these grandiose claims about the world's coming to an end, we're going to have a recession soon. And then it doesn't. So you predict a recession that doesn't happen, and there's no negative cost for that. Mm. You would think that people or economists who go on the air and say, we're in for a recession in the next year, or that the stock market should be at 36,000, and after a year when that doesn't materialize, they still get invited back to spew the same garbage, and there's no negative repercussions. Now, if a garbage man did that and said, yeah, I'm just not going to pick up garbage today, or I'm going to do a lousy job, they'd be fired. But economists don't seem to they seem to be subject to a different set of rules.
But the flip side is Professor Pacetti is presenting a paper in Washington soon on what topic and to who?
Okay, so sure. Thank you, Judith. A little shameless self-promotion. So I'm presenting a paper on with a colleague from Martha Olney from the University of California, Berkeley, about why a growing service sector and the deindustrialization in the U.S. has made recovery from recessions 40% longer than they've been in the past.
And who are you presenting this to?
The economists at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the folks who do the unemployment report and all of the major labor market variables.
I hope they listen.
So what happens when Larry Kudlow goes out on the lawn?
When Larry Kudlow what?
Goes out on the lawn of the White House and starts speaking. Is that like equal to an economist?
No, because he's not an economist and he's been wrong about literally everything he said for the past decade.
Yeah, but what was interesting, you're exactly right, but what was interesting was that when he did it the other day, based on the word of this, quote, non-economist guy who's been wrong about everything, the market turned around. Can you explain that to us?
The market can turn around for a lot of reasons.
Well, but it happened immediately, Aaron.
Sure. Okay. I mean, despite Kudlow not being an economist, that he is the spokesman for the Trump administration's, he's one of the spokesmen for the Trump administration's economic policy. So if he says something that markets like, sure,
and
they'll go up.
Don't you think they are?
That doesn't mean he's right, though.
But what did he say? He said, basically, here's my translation. Oh, yeah, you don't have to believe any of this. We're going to turn it around. Don't worry about it. It's just negotiating techniques.
He was walking back the president's statements, and that gives people some hope. And I think the market responded to that.
But Judith, do you think that the people who are going to do investing would have listened to him if they didn't think that Trump had sent them out there?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of speculation in that. Stock indices can respond to the smallest bit of news, and then you get feedback effects where it can be amplified, and then you have overenthusiasm, and then a week later people realize that, oh wait, we overreacted, and now we got to claw this back. And all of this uncertainty about Trump saying this and then somebody else saying, no, that's not true, all that does is create more and more gyrations and volatility, which is not good for the economy.
Well, I find it very scary because we are talking about, what was it? Joe, you're the expert on the computer here. I think it was like 500 points down and then another couple of points, 100 points up or another 100 points up. That's extraordinary in the course of a few minutes.
Yeah, it is.
Trump world.
Yep.
The Dow dropped nearly 500 points. However, Kudlow said you have to look at the overall percentage. The 500-point drop represents only 2% of the market, and people shouldn't overreact right now, and then the market righted itself.
Yeah, but what was he saying between the lines? That's the question, which is, this is not real. That's what I think people were hearing.
I think Kudlow is also saying, oh, my God, what have I gotten myself into?
Yeah.
Fox was so stable. Lee writes a note and has this subject line, are rich people worse? All these cabinet guys are rich to begin with. Pruitt surely can afford to pay market rates. How can they be so cheap, to say nothing of dishonest?
How can they be so stupid? I mean, this is what gets everybody into trouble. Assembly people, senators, governors, they get so arrogant that they think they can get away with anything. And in fact, that means that up to now, they have been getting away with everything, don't you think?
They get away with more than is actually revealed and they are held accountable for. And that's the thing with Pruitt. If he'll do this crazy stuff, what else has he done?
Now, the Pruitt thing, and I don't want to, I know we've sort of moved on here, but the one of the parts of that article, besides the flashing lights and the sirens, which was, I really enjoyed that part, but the get smart cone of silence that he wanted to, this whole
$40,000 phone booth,
this room where he could have conversations. Now, you've worked in the EPA. Is that necessary to have that kind of cloak and dagger?
No. When I worked at the EPA, and if I was having a sensitive conversation, I would rise from my desk and close the door. That's how you handle
quiet.
What
was that door made of?
junk.
Okay.
But it was a very nice federal building with 1970s furniture that people kept urging me to replace the furniture. And I'm like, no, it works. What would happen to it? But I do want to say on the $40,000 secret phone booth, two floors down from where the administrator works, there is a skiff. It is a private room where you go for security briefings and you leave your cell phone outside. I've been in that room. That's where you have, if there's something that is super confidential and you have to be really careful, you just go to another floor in the building. You don't need the phone booth, the $40,000 phone booth in the office.
Alan? Yeah, but you know what, Judith? You have to put this in the context of what you were doing and what this guy is doing. You know, you were an honest broker. You were on the side of the environment. You were doing the right things. And you got up and you closed the door. So what? I'm not being critical of you, but exactly. You were telling the truth as you saw it. These guys are in cahoots. And that's the problem. That's why they need the private phone booth.
I bet you he used the phone booth a lot this week.
Exactly.
You know, the other hypocritical thing here is that Trump's big campaign pledge was to drain the swamp. And it looks like instead of draining it, he's turning on a fire hose and continuing to flood it.
He's turning it into a cesspool.
Yeah, sure.
Mike writes to us. He is in. He's visiting Lisbon, Portugal, and he's on spring break. But he writes to us. He's still listening and says, "I'm hearing people here compare Donald Trump to their deposed dictator, Antonio Salazar. This is not a good thing." Well,
and go sightseeing if you're in Portugal. Just get out there, guy. We'll be here when you're back.
but not yet. There are those of us who believe that. Trump is leading us down the road to a totalitarian state in which, you know, he's president for life. That isn't happening yet. Could be where he's going. But I got to tell you, he's got to win a second election. And that's where the rubber's going to hit the road.
And he has to survive the Mueller probe.
Yeah, indeed.
And the military coup that might follow that.
All right. One more letter and then we'll go to a break, which is from Barbara, who says, "Good morning, panel. Stefanik says those things about Pruitt because of his ethics, but not his policies.
Right.
The regulation destroying policies are killing us. Help, Judith, help."
Yeah, so I went up to Glens Falls and met with the PostStar editorial board recently and laid out all of her failings. She has a very, very low environmental voting score. And, you know, my view is that's kind of the basics. When the bill gets to the floor, you should vote the right way. And I was highly critical of her not holding EPA accountable for not enforcing the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, because she represents the Adirondack Park, a part of the country that will be almost more hard hit than any other part of our land because of these terrible environmental policies. The air pollution coming from Midwestern power plants will contribute to acid rain and climate change. I will add, there are a large number of very strong Democrats running in a primary to take her on. So voters in that district, go look up who's running and see who has strong environmental records and jump in and get involved. Because I think one reason why Stefanik may have made this statement yesterday about Pruitt is because it's an election year and she wants to appear to be a little bit more pro-environment. That said, I'm glad she did call for Pruitt to step down.
All right. Yes. We are. Go ahead, Alan.
No, I completely agree. We got in a number of letters making this exact point that you have to sort of distinguish the man from from his policies. But it's the man's policies. So his going could only be good.
All right. We are late. So let's go to a break. When we come back, we will continue. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org.
I'm trying to love my neighbor, do good to others. Oh, mother, things ain't going so well. I ain't talking. I'm just walking
through this weary world of woe.
The amazing Betty LaVette. This is from her new album, Things Have Changed. It is an album of Bob Dylan covers, and Betty will be performing at Helsinki Hudson tomorrow night. HelsinkiHudson.com for more information. HelsinkiHudson.com. Let us get back to our conversation this morning, and, well, let's go to tariffs. So if you're following this at all, this started with the announcement of $50 billion in tariffs that the White House detailed on Tuesday. The Chinese government came out on Wednesday and said, well, here is our volley back to you, a $50 billion tariffs on these goods. And then Donald Trump yesterday said that the United States would consider slapping tariffs on an additional $100 billion in Chinese goods, escalating a potentially damaging trade dispute with Beijing. The president said in a statement that he was responding to unfair retaliation by China, which published a list on Wednesday of $50 billion in American products that would be hit by tariffs. That could not have come as a surprise. There would be a retaliation.
No. And a little quiz for everybody. Guess what's going to happen next?
China will. But now, my understanding from what I was hearing last night, they have less leveraging power than we do, correct?
They have a lot less leverage because, the U.S. imports about $500 billion worth of goods from China, $500 billion, whereas China imports only $130 billion of goods from the U.S. So the amount of – or the value mm-hmm. of the goods that China can impose tariffs on is, about a quarter of what we can impose on them. However, China does have an advantage in that they can weather that storm because of the very strong role of state-run banks, state-run infrastructure projects. So they can weather this storm no problem.
They're a dictatorship, right? So one of the things that I would ask you is what about – because people keep writing me about this. What about the paper that China owns in the United States?
By paper, you're referring to China's holding of U.S. Treasury securities, yes. U.S. government bonds.
Our debt, right?
Our debt, right. Our debt, which is an asset to China. There's a big misconception because China's strategy to promote export-led growth involved making the Chinese yuan much weaker relative to the dollar. So imports from China, because of their holdings of a massive amount of U.S. government debt, made those exports to the U.S. substantially cheaper. So if China were to start unloading those, they would be doing as much damage to themselves as they would to the U.S. because that would make Chinese exports to the U.S. far less competitively priced. So China will not be unloading those in any mass quantities at any point because it will do as much damage to the Chinese economy as it would to the U.S. fiscal position.
Interesting. And while we're on the subject, there's been much made of their targeting, the Chinese targeting the red states.
Yes.
Want to talk about that a minute?
Sure. I mean, that was the same thing that the European Union did with their proposed tariffs
on Kentucky
bourbon and Wisconsin-made Harley-Davidsons. So, China is, I believe it was soybeans and pork were the big recipients of the tariffs. And if you look at U.S. agricultural output, it is very closely correlated with how those states vote politically, and that is Republican. So China's not stupid. They are targeting very politically vulnerable parts of the country in terms of the 2018 midterm elections, and you can even look forward to the 2020 presidential election. So China's just not selectively choosing strategically important goods like Trump is. He's claiming this is being done on national security grounds. China's just poking Trump in the eye with their fingers, saying, yeah, okay, you want to do this? We're going to hit products that come out of states that have voted for you, and you're going to feel the pain for that.
So one other point about all of this is none of this is clicked in yet, right? So that's very important to remember.
Correct.
That there's an awful lot of, yeah, you said, he said, you know, that kind of thing. So what do you expect to happen?
yes, the crystal ball. So Trump's clearly trying to use this as a negotiating strategy in terms of how China treats U.S. intellectual property in really advanced technologies like artificial intelligence. I think that's the leverage that, you know, U.S. companies want applied, because that is obviously very valuable intellectual property. But at some point, you know, like imagine a little shoving match happening outside a bar at 2 a.m. Somebody says something back, and then it's a push, and then it's another push. And at some point, it could erupt into a straight up brawl. Now,
or they could just both collapse in a drunken haze.
Well, that's true, too.
Or somebody gets murdered.
So, I hope Trump's economic advisors understand that even though the U.S. has a lot more leverage in imposing tariffs on Chinese goods coming into the U.S. just because of the sheer volume, China can weather that storm very easily because of the role of the state in protecting certain industries and creating job opportunities through public infrastructure projects. The other issue is that China is very strategically important politically now with the impending negotiations with North Korea.
Yeah.
So the U.S. really needs China as an ally in those negotiations. Does Trump see that? I really hope so. I don't think he's that clueless. I think his advisors can point that out. And maybe this is just a lot of hot air that he's using to kind of, you know, say like, hey, look, I ease the tensions on this. But there is the other risk that this could blow up in his face.
All right, let's pause there. We have a news break. Ray Graff is standing by. We will take our break and we will return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Friday morning. It's the 6th of April, 8 minutes past 10 o'clock. Alan Chartok is here, Judith Enk, Aaron Pasitti, and we are talking about a lot of important stuff, and we're welcoming your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Yes, sir.
I just wanted to make a point. I love Ray Graff. You know, he's the best of the best. There's no two ways about it. And he teaches us something new every day.
What did he teach us today?
A new word, which I had never heard before. It's going to be clousy, as opposed to both lousy and cloudy.
Clousy.
I mean, it doesn't get better than that.
That's good. I like it.
It's very Ray Graff.
Clousy weather. It could be a song. Betty Levette will record it.
It sounds great.
All right, we have other topics to get to, so let's get to them. And are we done on tariffs?
Can I say one more thing?
Absolutely.
On tariffs? Trump's whole goal is to promote domestic industry over foreign imports, and that's a perfectly reasonable, economically viable goal. He's just doing it in the wrong way. Trade wars have a tendency not to work. You can look at the history of trade wars and protectionism,
right,
and they end up where both sides of the trade war lose.
So, Aaron, what's the right way?
The right way is so the U.S. could pursue a much weaker dollar strategy to make their exports more competitive by essentially buying foreign government bonds. There could be funding for apprenticeship, vocational training, retraining of workers who lost jobs in manufacturing industries. You could have more radical things like the government being an employer of last resort, essentially a second New Deal. You could have basic incomes that replace, you know, this hodgepodge of welfare programs so that displaced workers are just guaranteed, you know, $40,000 or $50,000 a year. Interestingly, that basic income is the libertarian solution to the deindustrialization. The people on the left are more in favor of, you know, government guaranteed employment. But the trade war is leading to, I mean, it's already caused massive volatility in financial markets and a lot of economic uncertainty. So when U.S. businesses are faced with uncertainty, they tend to pull back and just kind of freeze and wait for the water to settle, which means less business investment, purchasing fewer capital goods, and that all affects employment. So at 8:30 this morning, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, where I will be presenting on Monday, released their employment report for the month of March. And what it showed was that job growth slowed substantially from February. The economy added 103,000 jobs. So we have substantially slowing employment growth. And that just might be the tip of the iceberg, that as employers see increasing volatility and in how we're going to pursue trade agreements with the rest of the world, what the stock market looks like, that's going to result in slowing employment growth. And this all has the potential, and I say potential, to choke off what has been a very long, slow recovery, but a recovery that is starting to pick up speed. He's doing this at a very inopportune time, and there's better ways to accomplish it.
We are so proud that you're with us, Aaron. I mean, you really are.
You know, John Maynard Keynes said, economists should be like dentists. You only need them when you're in pain. And it seems like we need dentists nonstop now with the Trump administration. So happy to be here.
Except that the smart dentists are the ones who make sure you're brushing and flossing and being examined in order to ward off the pain.
True.
Don't you see?
So I'll consider myself a good dentist then,
yes,
Alan?
We're gonna allow you to think of yourself as a good dentist.
So I have a PhD and a DDA,
But more important, you're a great banjo player.
Yes. Can I make a quick plug about that real quick?
Sure. Plug away. What do you got?
So a bunch of Cambridge musicians, including myself and my wife, are playing at Brown's Wollumsack Tap Room on Thursday, April 12th from 6:30 to 9, where we will be doing a bunch of bluegrass, old time. We're going to do some International Workers of the World wobbly songs. Mm-hmm. So it's a great five-piece, and the Brown's Wollumsack Tap Room is an absolutely wonderful space.
There's no place more gorgeous than there. It's right on the river.
Yep.
Yeah, the waterfall is right there. You just sit there. You hear the water. You hear the music. You have a beer.
And it's in Cambridge?
It's in Hoosick Falls.
Hoosick Falls.
Hoosick Falls.
Yay! Yay!
I'll meet you there.
Yes!
Okay. Yeah, great. Okay.
Let's go.
Thursday the 12th, 6:30.
I thought it was, but I was getting confused. With
it's right by that little mini post office.
Yeah, yeah. And they need clean water in Hoosick Falls to make the beer. It always comes back to Hoosick Falls.
Go ahead, Alan, for Aaron.
Aaron, I take it that you'll be singing, you were talking about the IWW songs, the classic Verkus Unite, the left is in the right?
No, I think it's, I forgot the name of the song. We literally learned it on our last practice, so I don't know. But just for the record, I don't sing, and when I do sing, it's... I think you'd rather listen to Donald Trump talk about economic policy than listen to me sing.
Oh, you're that
it's
bad.
Dental.
It's dental.
It's mental.
What time on April 12th?
6:30 to 9.
Great.
You're taking notes. All right. Browns and all right. Well, we're doing plugs. Judith, what have you got going on?
Not nearly as exciting, but...
But probably more important.
Please come to the Science March to restore science into our government decision-making. It's at the state capitol on April 14th from 1 to 4.
So that's a week from this Saturday.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Rain or shine, bring your kids, lots of exhibits. And then secondly, I'll be moderating a panel on the future of solar at Gilderland Public Library on April 28th, I think at 1:00. And the key speaker there is Dr. Richard Perez of SUNY Albany, who is an international expert on big solar rather than big oil. So mark your calendar, Gilderland Public Library, the afternoon of April 28th.
All right. Excellent. Alan, anything you want to plug?
Only my well-heralded appearance at Hunter College on the 14th of April. But you have to be really an alumni to attend that of Hunter.
Or maybe know an alumni.
Or maybe what?
Or know an alumni.
Or know an alumni. Yeah, yes, you can come.
All right. Well,
you know, Cynthia Nixon went to Hunter. Just saying.
I do know that because I was talking to a very high official at Hunter the other day. And she said, what do you think? She said, that's a hint. What do you think Cynthia Nixon's chances are of winning? And, you know, I gave her my answer.
All right. So you were out campaigning with Cynthia Nixon this week.
I was. I endorsed her.
And what do you think?
I think she's absolutely terrific. I think she is what we need in state government today. She is viewed as a long shot candidate, but I would remind people that in the last Democratic primary for governor, where Zephyr Teachout challenged Governor Cuomo, less than 10% of registered Democrats voted. in that primary. So if Cynthia Nixon can energize Democratic voters to come out and vote in September, I would not rule her out. I think, you know, she just announced recently, I think voters are going to get to know her. I think she's really smart. She's fantastic on the environment, which is why I endorsed her. And I think it's time that we have a woman governor in New York. We've had three lieutenant governors, Marianne Krupschak, Betsy McCoy Ross, and our current lieutenant governor, Kathy Hochul. So,
wasn't there another one?
Maybe. I'm only remembering
who
three.
Who was the Donnie?
With Carrie?
No, the first, after Betsy McCoy Ross, wasn't there, she lived in Troy.
Oh, Mary Donahue.
Mary Donahue.
Oh, thank you, Joe.
You're very welcome.
Related?
I said Donahue, and then I thought it was,
I stand corrected. Yeah, she was the Rensselaer County DA, very nice woman. Right. So we have had four lieutenant governors in recent memory, but why not a woman governor in all of New York? And it's not that I'm supporting her just because she's a woman. She is a smart, progressive woman, and I think she would be a fantastic governor.
Well, first of all, I want to say that I agree with you. This is not to be considered an endorsement because I'm not making an endorsement.
Of course.
But I agree with you. She is terrific, and she holds nothing back. But the thing you all want to keep an eye on are the Working Families Party. It's a small party. However, it does what the Liberal Party used to do. Sometimes it presents an alternative. I think Cuomo's getting a little crazed about the fact that they might endorse Nixon. And if that happens, anything could happen in a general election. And the question is, would she stay in or would she somehow get out? I couldn't agree with you more. I think she is great and she's got guts and she's getting in Andrew's face, which I think is wildly, wildly deserved.
I like this idea of her going up the thruway, and I liked her going to Hoosick Falls. I thought that was an important early event.
Yeah, I was very impressed. Her folks reached out. We pulled it together quickly, and the most important thing was that the residents of Hoosick Falls were so impressed that she made the trip there. She listened to them. She understood what they're going through, and it's not even close to being over. We don't have the PFOA contamination cleaned up. We don't have an alternative water supply identified by the state. And, you know, I would point out that Governor Cuomo has never sat down with the residents of Hoosick Falls. He's only been there once. He snuck in on a Sunday morning to announce the new carbon filtration system being installed, which is a wonderful thing. And then he very inappropriately joked about what a great system it is. He joked about the color of it, while people in Hoosick were worried about the health impacts of drinking contaminated water for so long, while his health department didn't tell people, particularly pregnant women who could have avoided this water source. So Cynthia Nixon announces just a few weeks ago, she gets right to Hoosick Falls, and the important thing was the reception she got from the residents there who were all just so impressed with her, as was I.
But, you know, it's even more important than just Hoosick Falls, because by going to Hoosick Falls, she announces basically that she gives a damn about upstate New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then she went on to Syracuse and in Rochester. You know, she's not a household name other than people who watched her TV show.
Sex and the City.
But she's a very accomplished actress, and which I don't think should be held against her. But she will have a problem upstate and does have a problem with name recognition. So her going out there is very positive, and she'll be back.
All right. We have 5 minutes. It's 20 after. And so Donald Trump says he didn't know his attorney paid $130,000 to porn star Stormy Daniels. He didn't get that memo. Said to basically to reporters who finally were able to ask him. I think, Alan, you said earlier that he's on a roll, and it seemed to be that this is what's happening over the last couple of days. He threw out a speech at West Virginia yesterday. He ambled back to the press quarters of the plane of Air Force One and took a couple of questions. He's been dodging questions on the Stormy Daniels issue for weeks and finally said that he knew nothing. Right. Yeah, it's a first public response to the questions about the payment, and the president said he did not know where his attorney, Michael Cohen, got the money, and he declined to say whether he had ever set up a fund for Cohen to cover such expenses. But he did really throw Cohen under the bus, it seems.
Yeah, well, two things. One is he created a world of hurt for his legal options here, because if he was not aware of it, his lawyer could not have signed on his behalf.
Right.
And so Stormy Daniels, Stephanie Clifford's lawyer, who's been all over the media, very confident young man, is thrilled. He says this is Christmas and Hanukkah all at once. And other legal observers have said this is a big problem.
Because that negates the legality of the non-disclosure agreement?
The contract doesn't exist if one of the main participants.
And they're suing for $1 million per occurrence of deviating.
For her speaking.
Yes, right.
But I think the bigger issue here was that question at the end, was a fund set up. You remember in that book, Fire and Fury, the author quotes Steve Bannon as saying that there are hundreds of non-disclosure agreements between our president and various women. My view is this is really looking like a Harvey Weinstein type situation, where it's possible that there's this whole institutional apparatus set up to defend Trump when there are numerous accusations. Some may be consensual relationships, some may not. Remember, we still have 14, 15 women who said that they experienced unwanted, unwelcomed sexual advances from our sitting president. I'm beginning to think this is very Harvey Weinstein-esque in terms of a whole apparatus to protect him in this area.
Yeah, but, you know, talk about this just ain't right. The idea is that we have the Me Too movement now, we have people coming forward, we have Harvey Weinstein, we have all of that, and the chief, you know, abuser is the president of the United States.
It boggles my mind how somebody like Mike Pence could second tolerate this. I mean, we all know where he stands.
Now, we only have about a minute, but there's this NPR story that they broke yesterday that the
evangelicals.
Thank you very much, Judith. Are planning to meet with Trump in June. To discuss. Well, because they're worried about their interests and how they will be lost in the midterms.
Well, they better get in there quicker than June, for goodness sake.
But that's a huge sacrifice. I mean, that's like one of the pillars of the evangelical platform, and they're just saying, "Yeah, we'll tolerate this because we want a Republican in office."
Mulligan.
Right.
Well,
he gets probably a couple hundred mulligans.
The Atlantic has a really good cover story recently on Trump's relationship with the evangelical community. And it all comes down to they want very conservative judges appointed, future federal district court and Supreme Court appointed judges. So they will just hold their nose and look away. There is a little bit of polling data that women evangelicals have had enough, but it's a remarkably small number that are turning away.
All right, we're out of time. My thanks to everybody. Alan, thank you very much. Judith, Aaron, have a lovely weekend. Be well. We'll be back right after this.